I'm Tariq Wakid. Welcome to Between Two Rounds. Today we have Sandeep Kumar, CFO and board director at Gravitix, and a good friend of mine. So excited to share this conversation today. Welcome, Sandeep.
Excited to be here, man.
Yeah. So how's it been? Two brown guys taking over space? Are you excited about it?
So excited. Couldn't be more excited. I think space generally needs a lot of new talent from different industries and different backgrounds, and I'm excited to be partnering with you. Tackle a bunch of this stuff.
Likewise. We have butted heads in the past, so
part of the game.
Tell us a little bit about yourself. Like, how did you? Who are you? What have you? So other people can know as much as the same way I know you.
Yeah, I grew up overseas. I grew up in Paris, France. My family moved out there when I was about 8 years old, and I always think of that as being pretty formative. A formative experience for me. I basically came back for high school, did high school in Houston and college at University of Texas, studied mechanical engineering, Hook'em Horns. Yeah. And ultimately, you know, I'd always wanted to move into tech. I wanted to spend time working on sort of frontier industries. And, you know, University of Texas was a big oil and gas school when I was there. And so, you know, the opportunities everyone was chasing after were opportunities at Chevron, opportunities at Exxon. And I remember the first time I ever got a rejection letter from, I think it was Chevron. And I was so bummed out because these were like the high salary jobs, the big opportunities that everyone was talking about coming out of the engineering school. And I got on the phone with my dad, and my dad was like, Sandeep, did you go and get your engineering degree so that you could go work at Chevron? Or did you get your engineering degree so you could go work, you know, on the frontier, like on sort of next generation technology? And that was sort of a key moment in my life where I was like, you know, that is why I got my engineering degree. And so I ended up going and working at Dell as a way to go learn manufacturing and supply chain. And how do you build things? How do you manage big teams? How do you put out fires? With the goal of jumping to a startup right after. And I ended up founding my first company in 2016 with a guy that I met in Austin that was looking to create Yelp for off-campus housing. And we turned it into a transactional marketplace for end-to-end transactions for college housing.
When did you graduate?
2014.
Okay. UT. It's crazy how when we leave college, all the ideas we have for tech are things we only experience in college.
It's so like fundamental, like you build around what you know. Yeah. And so, you know, my co-founder for that company had dropped out of school, realizing it was crazy that people were making decisions about trying to, you know, sign an apartment based on signs on the side of a street, and said, I need to solve this. At that point in my life, you know, University of Texas was a big college housing market. So I was living in Austin. I was like, oh my God, there's a huge opportunity here. And so it made sense for me to partner with him and try to build that business.
I think one of the things that make a good founder or a good operator is saying, I don't know how this, I can solve this problem. And I don't know if there's a better way to do this, but this way that it's being done is not the right way. And then just setting forth a course to solve it.
I mean, like, I think that's, it's so important because I think when you're telling people how to think about going about starting a company, I always think the best advice is start actually just writing down the things that you see that are broken. Because if you're not actively capturing what's not working out there, it's really hard to then like sit there and think about what you want to improve on. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's like the number one skill set for any entrepreneur is like just start documenting the problems that you're seeing. So you have a list of stuff that you can look at and say, hey, that was broken. I don't know why it was working that way. And then I think the idea generation comes, you know, out of that process.
100%. And for me, like when I started my first tech startup, I was in Latin America and I'm lazy. So I didn't have groceries in my fridge. So I was like, oh, in the US, I can just use an app to call groceries.
Right.
And there's nothing that exists here. So I was like, I don't know how to program or fundraise or do anything. I was like, I just want to solve that problem.
Totally.
And having like the guts to be capable of failing even in that process. Most people need to have everything planned out before they make a decision.
Totally.
And I think a good founder is able to jump out of the plane and build the parachute on the way down.
Totally. I think, and maybe this is not even a founder characteristic, but a great innovator also is really thoughtful about what part they play in that innovation. Because I think like the best innovators and sort of game-changing entrepreneurs I've ever met have this really deep understanding of what they're really good at and what they're not good at. And so when it comes down to actually solving the problem, they tend to have like these really thoughtful ways of thinking about, hey, do I need to be the CEO of this company, or do I just need to be the best fundraiser that I can be for this company? Yeah. Do I need to be the person that builds the initial team and sends them on their way, or yeah. do I need to be an operating member, right?
But then you also have folks like Zuckerberg, who wasn't the best CEO long term for the company, but he built himself he built the skill set that he needed to grow Facebook and to become that. You've seen him evolve over the last decades, and he wasn't that same person.
Yeah, and you know, I think the argument today is that he is the best CEO that Meta could possibly have. And you know, I think there were a lot of different points where maybe that was a question. I don't think people are questioning it as much, but I think he's like a prime example.
He's like boxing now and stuff.
I mean, he's just a prime example of like, if you want to remain the CEO of a company on, you know, a 10 plus year, even a 5 plus year yeah. time horizon, like evolution is part of the game.
100%.
You need to evolve. People need to see that evolution. It can't be the place you started and the place you ended. People need to see real delta.
Well,
there.
For startups, but also personally.
Personally too.
You know?
It's for recruiting, it's for building the company, it's for managing your own like mental health and kind of who you are. There's so many reasons as to why you need to evolve, but like the person that starts the business with 10 people in the room and the person that's running it with thousands of people in the room, like, you know, out of necessity needs to evolve and grow.
And I think humility is probably the biggest thing that I've, over the last few years, I've picked up on, whether it's my personal life or whether it's business. When you achieve something, you tend to lose humility because like, oh, I did it, or it was me, or, you know, I was right, or what have you. But you realize that there were so many things that played in the part of why that happened, whatever it is. And being humble enough to continue learning, even after you've achieved great success, even after you've achieved great success, allows you to look inward and figure out what are those things that I need to improve upon. So, you know, with that being said, how did you get into the space industry?
Yeah, so I, in 2020, in the middle of COVID, one of our good friends, Nick Shekardemian, sent me Axiom Space's deck. And I remember at that point, I was just looking at doing my first handful of angel investments. And this was really one of the first deep tech investments I had ever looked at. And I remember reading through the deck and thinking to myself that it was sort of the first time I'd ever seen a pitch deck that I actually felt was sci-fi. As I was reading through it, you know, just reading about we are going to be the biggest real estate operator in space and you know, thinking about space stations as real estate, like all of these new sort of notions just felt so mind-blowing to me. And I remember thinking at that point, I have no idea where to even start with innovation in this sector. But man, if I can pull some capital together and put it into this company, I'll gain more perspective around this industry than most people would. And that might be my route to at least figuring out what I could do in this space. And so it really started there. Over the next 2 years, as I was running a sort of future of work HR tech company, I just completely realized that my interest had just moved so far towards deep tech that some of this traditional B2B SaaS, you know, the HR products that I was building just – they weren't meeting sort of the like innovation criteria or threshold that I needed. I wasn't excited. And I didn't feel the impact that I needed to want to come to work every day and feel like, hey, I want to build something and I want to build this team and motivate this team to go and tackle it. Space was, it was such a mind-blowing concept. And then as I learned and got deeper and deeper into why these things are important to invest in, you know, my faith only grew in the sector. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, when I wound down my last company and realized, hey, you know, founder market fit isn't here in this space, but I do think I have some fit here in this deep tech space. That's when I started speaking to Nick. That's when you and I connected. And really, I just wanted to come to the space sector and bring what I knew I was good at, which was, you know, fundraising, you know, building teams and creating, you know, really thoughtful strategies for go-to-market.
You're also really good at telling a story. And simplifying a complex idea into a very thoughtful, quick idea to understand.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Yeah.
And so for me, you know, very similar. When in 2019, got involved in VC, started seeing the space companies that were being built and were being needed fundraising and were raising their seed rounds and Series A's. And I saw the opportunity as I dug in deeper of like launch costs coming down because there's innovation. Somebody built a widget, i.e. SpaceX, that makes the access and the cost to get to space cheaper.
Yeah.
And the biggest like reason why the industry operated through the government in the way it did was that it was very expensive and access to launch was few and far between.
Right.
So all the startups or all the companies building whatever satellite had to be sure that that satellite... Because you have one shot every year or every two years to deliver it.
Totally.
Now you have a Falcon 9 every month, every week. Right. And soon we'll have Starship. So we kind of saw that and just dove headfirst. The future of space I saw was fast shipping, innovative products, lower costs for those products because you're shipping more of them.
Yeah.
And we invested in Gravitix. And yeah. So when Nick introduced me to you... I was like, dude, you got to go work with Gravitix. Like, they need you there.
Yeah.
And it's really cool to see how far we've come in that, like, thesis of building more innovative products. So maybe tell us a little bit about Gravitix. What does Gravitix do? How is it important to that trajectory of yours with Axiom, having invested in Axiom? And why did you take the opportunity in 2021?
Yeah. You know, quickly to touch on the shipping velocity thing, which I think is really important. I think there's just like interesting take in aerospace today that I fundamentally like don't really believe in, which is that because aerospace is so complex, right, and so technical that you build the business so fundamentally differently compared to what you would do in traditional tech.
Right? Like how?
And like because it's so complex, you need more dollars earlier to invest in more technologies earlier to show more progress.
But is
earlier
it really that much more complex?
Well, I think that is sort of my argument. I think the argument is that the complexity increases, but that's even more of a reason to bring traditional product strategy into it, right? Like the traditional product strategy of like focusing on shipping, focusing on iteration, focusing on getting feedback from the market works better with more complex products, right? Because more complex products inherently require you to kind of work on them longer before you crack it. Mm-hmm. The problem is you can waste a lot of money in that process if you don't break that complex problem into concrete scopes that you tackle one at a time and you just focus on, hey, get the next thing out, get the next thing out, get some feedback. And so I think what's been really important to me when I've started working with aerospace companies and spending time with companies like Gravitix is how do we bring that traditional product mentality to the table for the aerospace company, set really thoughtful milestones for ourselves and say, hey, building to the moment where we get our first space station module is going to be broken down into 16 steps. And we're going to make, you know, multiple of these steps fundraising moments for the company. And we're going to prove out product traction and business development traction side by side. You know, just because it's more complex doesn't mean you throw out the playbook. It actually means you stick to the playbook even harder is sort of my take on it.
And so for everyone who's not aware of Gravitix, what does Gravitix do in relation to Axiom?
Yeah, so Gravitix really is a space infrastructure company. And so what we build are these multi-purpose modules that can be used in orbit for a variety of different purposes, whether it be for stations, so an actual habitat for astronauts or a module docked to a station that's being used for power or something like that, or whether, you know, it be, you know, the $125 million contract that we signed with Axiom Space, that's really about using that module for cargo delivery. And so delivering cargo to their station and giving them the ability once they remove the cargo to just have more space in their station accordingly. And
how does it work currently for if you want to build a space station where you bring astronauts to the station? What is the paradigm?
Yeah, so 70% of the station that's up there today was by volume was built by Thales Alenia.
How many people fit Italy on that station on the ISS today? Maybe like 8, 10?
I think it's like 8 to 10.
Can we pull it up?
Total people at any given time. I mean, it's very small quarters for these astronauts. When you see videos, you see, you know, trash bags, you know, all over the place, wires everywhere. There's not a lot of room for storage. It really wasn't built for, let's say, long-term living on that station,
because it cost so much to get up there back then.
Totally.
And now that cost is dropping, so that has to change.
And that was basically, you know, I think Gravitix was born out of the idea that launch costs are coming down. The last 15 years has been all about orbital accessibility. How do we get to orbit? How do we get to orbit more often? How do we get more up to orbit? And what we've seen over the last 15 years, because the satellite industry was seen as being so valuable, was this launch industry came up and really gave us the ability to say, hey, we're flying every 3 days. We're flying at a fraction of the cost. We can get significantly more up there. Mm-hmm. As that started to come into reality, people like Colin Dawn, our founder and CEO, really started thinking about, okay.
It dawned on him.
what is the next generation of these modules and these stations that can go up, right? The first version of Gravitix was really around building space station modules to replace the International Space Station. But over time, we realized that if the last 15 years has been about orbital accessibility, the next 15 years is just going to be about what happens in orbit. Mm-hmm. And for things to happen in orbit, you just need infrastructure broadly, whether it be a space station module, a pressurized module for you to host an application in, or whether it be, you know, the cargo logistics need of getting whatever equipment you need in that module to the module, right?
And then when you have more people up there, you need more supplies for those people or for those experiments.
Totally.
And so if it costs you a lot of money because those modules are disposable or they just have one use, then there's always a barrier to entry of who can use it, what applications make sense to use it, right?
Totally. And look, like the foundation that Axiom really went to market with was, we're going to build a modular station. That's what we're going to do in the future. And we see ourselves as being sort of the property developer behind them building these
modular space station, as in like one module works, generates revenue, another module, and so on and so forth.
Totally, but also like the ISS wasn't built in a way where you could really sort of remove modules, bring them out, you know, put the next one in. It wasn't built thinking about like a 30 to 50 year future of all the different parts of the module or the space station that are going to be taken away, rebuilt,
sure.
You know. And so the entire idea was, let's shift this to something that looks a lot more like Lego building blocks, where you're building on top of the station over time.
Yeah.
And if you want to move one module from this side of the station to the other side of the station, like, you just create a lot more flexibility around them. You also create modules that are inherently multi-purpose. And so, you know, we deliver a module that carries cargo to the station, but we outfit it with life support systems, so that after you remove the cargo from it, you can use it as another habitat, right?
Exactly.
You can use it as a place to manufacture something. You can use it as a place to test an orbital data center. And so I think what Gravitix is really trying to bring to the industry is, we build building blocks for orbital infrastructure,
okay,
right? Whether you need to tackle dedicated space in orbit for an application, for a habitat, for whatever it might be, whether you are using it for cargo logistics to get things around orbit, whether you're using it, whether the DoD is using it as a satellite carrier for redundancy purposes, we create the module, the building block that you can use for it. It allows you to focus on what happens inside the module, and we can focus on building the best spacecraft we can.
Yeah, and for me, why we invested in Gravitix was that we didn't see a long-term – let's actually take a step back, and then I'll explain why we were excited about it. You said 30 to 50-year vision for orbital infrastructure. What does it look like 30 to 50 years from now? Are we going to have – hundreds of people living in space stations, working in space stations? Is that future capable, or is it only going to be always related to governments?
Yeah, so I definitely don't think it'll only be related to governments. I think like we've seen in a lot of sectors and with a lot of technologies, like, the government is a great institution to push the technology forward initially. And then, you know, there's a reason why they start commercializing from there, because, you know, you have so much more opportunity for the technology to flourish. And so I think the government's done such a great job of standing up these programs with NASA, and also done a great job of saying, okay, now we don't want to own launch anymore, so we're going to commercialize it, right? And look at what that industry has become. I think we're going to enter sort of the same realm here on the space infrastructure side and the space station module side, the cargo infrastructure side, where the government realizes more and more that they just want to use commercial financial services to power government applications, right? So essentially how I think about this industry over the next, let's just call it 30 years, I think of space as having sort of three discrete gold mines. I think the first gold mine was the satellite industry. We realized through observation to power telecom.
Yeah, you know, the customers are on Earth. So
the customers on Earth, so it's easy.
Somebody right. pays for it on Earth. That's space for Earth, right?
Totally, right? And space for space as well. There's plenty of benefits and deep space exploration that's coming from that as well.
But it's smaller in the early years. Totally. It wasn't like a big market enough to drive investment required.
Exactly, right? They found a commercial loop, which was really about delivering value back on Earth, and they were able to build the launch industry to support that, right?
Yeah, so, without Starlink, SpaceX doesn't succeed.
Right, so now you have basically one gold mine that's understood and VCs are plowing money into it, and there's a lot of opportunity there. Okay. I think the next chapter is about gold mines 2 and 3. I think gold mine 2 is about resource extraction. I think this is really Jeff Bezos's like philosophy around why spend time in space. You know, in one of his more recent podcasts, he spoke about how for him it's about just the reality that we have finite resources on Earth. And so our job is to not only synthesize resources to the extent that we can, but also to like go out into space and find resources that we can use back on Earth, that we can use for in space applications, et cetera, right? And so I think we have a massive gold mine opportunity just around resource extraction out there, whether it be—
What's the timeline on that in your opinion?
I think the timeline is we're going to run our first tests and sort of discover our first resources here over the next, 5 years.
Lunar surface.
And then I think, the next 10 years is going to be about scaling that, right? Sure. And about thinking about how do we get those resources, move them around, make them more mobile.
And you have that already. There's like so many companies working on OTVs that move things around in orbit cheaper.
Totally.
And so ultimately, the resource extraction part of it, even bringing it back down to Earth, because there's companies like Jason Dunn, who was on the podcast prior, there are companies that are figuring out ways to take things in space and bring them back to Earth. Totally. Usually we always send things from Earth and just like, okay, they're satellites, great. But now we have usable materials that we can bring back down to Earth.
Totally.
Whether it's through space stations or companies like SpaceForge or Varda that are manufacturing in space and bringing them back down to Earth for use on Earth.
Yeah.
And resource extraction only makes sense, except for the edge applications like these manufacturing companies, where the cost parity is there.
Yeah.
If it's the same price to mine something in space than it is to mine something on Earth, we'll take it from space because Earth is our nature preserve.
Yep, totally.
So 100% agree there.
But so I think that's like sort of the second gold mine, right? And the way I see Gravitic specifically fitting into that whole thing is people are going to be mining asteroids, people are going to be mining the moon. And, there's, we call it solar mining as well, right? Going out and trying to extract a significant amount of solar power and redirect it and beam it. So resource extraction is going to be a big part of it. I think Gravitic's part in that whole thing is we will be the depots, right? Mm-hmm. And so you can use these modules in so many different ways as you're collecting resources stored in a depot, right? And I think sort of that's a part that we can play in that. I think the third gold mine that's really interesting is around microgravity innovation, around what can we actually do once gravity gets removed from the equation? I think this, to me, was a really fundamental reason that I joined Gravitics, was a realization that for all of history, 9.8 meters per second squared was sort of this constant that was in every innovation equation. And we've now suddenly sort of found this opportunity to innovate without it. Mm-hmm. And I just believe there's a tremendous amount that's going to come over the next 5 to 10 years as we start to really start to work on
that. I think it'll even be sooner.
My goal is that it happens for sure over the next 5 years.
And but also that we you can have spend the convergence next, of other technologies that are helping.
Totally.
AI and advanced materials and advanced manufacturing practices that are also influenced by additional AI.
Totally. And so we've spoken a lot about what those different use cases are, but just to talk about a couple of them, right? We recently generated an artificial retina and an artificial knee meniscus on the International Space Station. I think like biomanufacturing is such an interesting, organ manufacturing, such an interesting use case. Why? Because on Earth, to grow these organs, cells have to grow against gravity. And so the most expensive part of the entire cost stack is the scaffolding needed for cells to grow up against gravity.
When you make it here on Earth.
When you make it here on Earth. In microgravity, you no longer need the scaffolding. It grows organically. It grows naturally. It doesn't have to fight gravity in order to grow, right? And so that's like one specific example. As launch costs come down and down and down, you can see a world where, you know, you're manufacturing sheets and sheets of artificial retinas in space. The mass and volume profile is not large for these things. So you can take equipment up for a low cost. You can bring it down for relatively low cost. So the first
market is like finding things that we can manufacture in space.
With the right sort of profile on volume and mass that allow it to be feasible.
Small things for high value.
Right. And so that's like one example, right? I think another is semiconductor manufacturing, right? Crystalline growth on Earth. You know, you have efficiency losses due to gravity. In microgravity, you don't have to worry about that.
Some would argue that there's these free flyer companies that can do it. Do you think those are two different markets? Why would you need a space station to manufacture in space when you have the Vardas and the Space Forge of the world that are aiming to do it without a space station, without all the additional infrastructure?
Yeah, look, I think it comes down to just sort of time and roadmap more than anything else, right? I think when, you know, Austin, Texas was first sort of set up as a city, it made sense for people to go out there and set up, you know, a small abode for them to spend some time in and come back. And then over time, what happens, like the small abode becomes, you know, a housing complex of some kind, and the housing complex has amenities, and the amenities include power and other utilities that you need to just operate. And so for me, it's like, everyone should be trying to kind of get their own free flyer up there to test it in the near term. But then as you are thinking about scaling that, as you're thinking about, okay, well, we got a free flyer up there, but we want to run the next experiment without bringing that thing down. It's valuable to have a station there where you can dock it, you can remove things from it, you can replace things, and be able to operate with a little bit more infrastructure around you to support whatever you're building. I think it also is just a cost thing, right? Flying your own free flyer every single time versus flying one free flyer up and having some station that you can go dock at and try something else is just, I think, a more efficient way for that entire ecosystem to grow.
Here's a question for you. Having been a founder, an investor, and also an operator now in space, what do you think people that have spent their whole careers in space don't see of what needs to happen next in space? It's kind of like they're horses with blinders. This is how it's always been done. And you're coming in fresh, new set of eyes, trying to enact change within the industry, within these companies. And then also investors that are from outside of the space industry that are starting to get involved and wanting to invest in some of these companies. What do you find as like the biggest hurdle to convince people that space is valuable or it's worth an investment, it's worth, you know, what has been some thoughts that you've experienced?
Yeah, so I'll break it out into sort of my thoughts on investors and then my thoughts on sort of like operators and what they need to think about. I think on the investor side, the biggest hurdle is it really comes down to education. I think that's going to be a key part of Gravitic's roadmap over the next 6 months is educating people on Goldmine 2 and Goldmine 3.
Because a lot of people view as space as like, you know, it's nice to have.
Totally. And look, like I'm not arguing that that there aren't other important terrestrial
markets
for dollars to flow to, right? But I do believe that on the innovation front, there's just a lot to be done in space, a lot to learn, and a lot of growth, both like economically and just in perspective for humanity that'll come from spending time out there. And so I think for investors, it's thinking about, okay, hey, we've just spent a lot of money building the launch industry, getting this up and running. I think a lot of investors in the space are just starting to think about what's going to come next. Mm-hmm. What's the next 15 years? Mm-hmm. Okay, great. We're going to have a bunch of satellites on there, out there. We're going to empower
those satellites.
We'll have
people on Mars. Like you heard Elon. He said in 2 years they're trying to launch the first Starship to Mars without
crew. But even like before that, right? Like there are just applications that we need to go invest some money and figure out if there's a there. Yep. Right. And I think, you know, when you look at how venture capital has traditionally been used, like these are the bets that I want venture capital to be flowing towards, because I think they're just the massive humanity bets. If we can figure out how to extract resources more efficiently out there and leverage those resources on Earth and in space, like, what a great win for society. If we can figure out new ways to develop things in microgravity that we can do cheaper and better, you know, what a great way for venture
capitalists. I hear you, but I think for me, it's always been about humans.
Yeah, fair.
I think the super app for space is humans. And I think companies like Axiom and Gravitix unlock a layer. Like, imagine being able to go to space, have accommodations in space for whether it's leisure or research or what have you.
Yeah.
The government is the first layer. The applications like space, semiconductors and fiber optics, second layer.
Yeah.
But for it to be a massive industry, you need to have the going to Mars, infrastructure on the lunar surface, infrastructure in low Earth orbit. And I think people don't realize how quickly that is going to shift.
Yeah.
And it's like a step function. You have Falcon 9, Falcon Heavy, but Falcon 9, the Dragon, and then you're going to have Starship.
Yeah.
And that's a step function in terms of access, cost, amount of people. And what I've seen in space stations is there is no step function for space stations. It grows from 4 to 8 to 12 people in orbit, but then you're going to have – so, you know, that's like what we're trying to solve for here.
Yeah, look, I think we've spent some time in this conversation talking about sort of the economic loops and, you know, the value that can be delivered there. I think you're touching on something that I, like, firmly believe in, which is that I think at our core, humans are explorers. And I think when we stop exploring sort of the unknown out there in space, like, we are actually fighting against ourselves, right? And so, like, for me, I think the path to innovation starts with exploration, right? And so we need to get humans out there exploring. I like, generally believe that humans and robots will both exist out there, but I'm definitely not siding with one or the other. Like, I think both need to be out there.
100%.
Right? And that's really important.
And, you know, there's this new book by Robert Zubrind called What We Will Build on Mars.
Yeah.
And he was trying to figure out what is the export that Mars will do to Earth, because there's going to be imports from Earth to Mars, whether it's like small high-value items that you send on ships, computers and things like that you don't have specialized industry because there's not enough people on Mars.
Right.
You know, take whatever timeline you want. And then the export's going to be innovation, because any frontier, whether it's America, whether it's the New World created a lot of ideas because the people that move there are the ones that are driving for change. There's certain people that are comfortable and like to do the same thing, comfort, and there's people that take risks.
Well,
and
those risk takers, like,
will be drawn to that.
Yeah, it's also just like a first principle thing, which is like, hands-on is the best, and humans being there, experiencing things themselves. Quicker iteration cycles, just more fidelity in the beliefs. Like, I just think... I find it really hard to believe that the future of space is going to be purely robotic and us being scared of sort of this unknown that's out there and this inhospitable environment. I actually think humans are built to, like, fight against that, to go figure it out in order to gain firsthand experience.
100%.
So I'm a big believer.
I can't wait to see Gravitix and Axiom and all these space station companies be able to host hundreds of people in space. I'm not married, but I always say I want to – that's why I invested in Gravitix, because I want to, like – build that future where I can go get married in space. But I'm going to have a lot of friends that want to come.
Yeah.
So having a place to, like, host them all is going to be important.
Totally.
I'll take all my exits from Gravitix and type
one.
Just put it to the wedding. Very, very Lebanese thing to do. Spend all my money on a wedding and then be broke right after.
There you go.
And so tell us a little bit about yourself on a personal level, if you don't mind sharing. Like, what drives you? What excites you? What do you like to do? I know we've spent a lot of time outside of work as well.
Yeah. So, I mean, I live in Hermosa Beach. My wife and I moved there during COVID from New York, from Manhattan. I mean, I, like, built my sort of fundraising and entrepreneurial chops in the city, building companies, investing in companies out there. And then during COVID, it made sense to kind of come out to the West Coast and spend some time out here. I've found that... it's been really interesting to take sort of like 4 or 5 years of learning from New York and spend time in a place like LA where I find a little bit more balance in my life. And
so much.
And the balance, what I found is like, I love the hustle mentality and I find, you know, I'm a big believer in it. At the same time, I believe like it's important to hustle hard and then find time for like reflection to like actually think. And I feel like LA has been a great place for me to spend time with my family, spend time with my friends, work really hard, but then like be able to, you know, walk along the beach and just like think for a second, right? Yeah. And, you know, get some sun and sort of refresh through that. You know, what drives me is it's a good question. I've always been so driven to drive like large scale change. Like that has been a big part of why I became an entrepreneur, and the scale of change has been very important to me.
Where do you think that comes from? Like what gives somebody that, because there's people that want to make change and want to be like, you know, make that impact. And there's people that don't have any interest and they just like to keep to themselves. Like, what do you think maybe as a child that like, gives you that like inspiration to do that? Or is it innate?
You know, I think it's probably a mixture of things. Like, I think growing up overseas, coming back to the U.S., I, like, definitely built sort of a, you know, chip on my shoulder through all of that in wanting to prove something. And I don't know if it was proving capability, proving, you know, building my own confidence through that. But there was a chip on my shoulder just around, you know, wanting to mean something, like wanting to be something. And so when I came back to the U.S., it was really about sort of finding the way that I can move those things forward. And I remember when I was in Houston, it was like probably my sophomore year of high school. My family used to have this like very sort of intense perspective on every summer you got to be working, right? Like you're in school. We want you to focus on school, and every summer you need to be working. And you need to be very thoughtful about what job you got that summer.
Yeah.
Because that job's going to set you up for the next summer, right?
Right.
And so so tied with this sort of dynamic of who I am, of just like wanting to actually drive large-scale change, I had these parents that were like, tactically, we're going to put you to work. You need to go and figure out what it looks like to go do that. So like, you know, small IT help desk internships, you know, after my freshman year, after my sophomore year, I wasn't able to find an internship that I was really excited about. And I went to my parents and I was like, you know, what else are you guys thinking about? Like what else? And they're like, it's not our job. Like you need to figure something out. If you can't go find a job, then you find a way to make money yourself with your own small business sort of opportunity.
Oh, did you ever do any like little?
So I went, it was really funny. I like at that point in time, somehow had walked into a real estate sort of like brokerage in Houston.
It's sophomore year? College?
Sophomore year of high school.
High school.
And I went in and I basically just asked them.
Can we pull
up
a sophomore year picture of Sandeep?
let's not do that. But
I can imagine you as like what, 15? Like,
well, you know, talking about the chip on the shoulder, like until I was a senior in high school, I was 5'3".
Same.
So like it was like.
If you would have gone to space, your cells wouldn't need the scaffolding.
There you
would have gotten taller.
There you go. And so anyway, like I went into this real estate office and I was like, hey, you guys like really have the worst websites I've ever seen, like for all these individual brokers. And I was like, I'd love to like help you guys kind of just like turn this into something that looks
cool.
Did
you have a French accent?
No, I did not.
I would love to turn this into a... That's Arab.
So I went into this office and like these people were like completely stunned that anyone was even willing to help them. Like it was so obvious that their websites was such a problem for themselves. Like they were just like, I wish people could get better information more easily. And so before I knew it, I was just like spinning up websites for these real estate agents, right? And they were like, the first one that I did it for handed me $100. I thought it was like such an incredible amount of money, like $100 bill at that point. I was like, wow.
Dude, like, I spent like $100 on a DoorDash order. It's like, back then that was so much.
Totally.
It was like,
it meant so much, right? And so, Inflation. And so I did that. Yeah, there you go. I did that like sophomore year. And then, you know, junior year was another internship and senior year was another internship. And before I knew it, it was like I came to college and man, I had this like hunger for working.
Yeah.
And it was like, college then got reframed as like, okay, I'm going to learn these things, but it's not about these classroom situations.
It's not about like, the money
it's
either.
It's about going and building.
Yeah, because it's not about the money. If you're motivated to work for money, you never like wake up and want to go make that change. But if you know there's like a change at the end of it or an impact that you can have, I think it drives you a lot more.
Totally. And so basically I came out of college with this continued feeling that I needed to build something important. And with this like rigor around work ethic that my parents had instilled in me, that sort of set me up to be really a good profile to be a co-founder, right? Like where I want to build this big story and I have this ability to tell that story and to simplify the problem down in a way that resonates with people. But then at the same time, like, you know, no one's gonna like look at me and think that you know, this guy's gonna be spending a lot of time on the couch, so to speak, right? Yeah. Like I'm just out there, right? And I remember like at LoftSmart getting reviews for that platform. What we did is we would go out to campus and we'd buy pizzas and we'd literally hand out slices of pizzas to students walking out of the engineering school and the business school. And so for, you know, whatever, 80 cents a slice, we were able to get a review on our platform. Sick. And we built to thousands of reviews just giving pizzas out. But like that was the mode. The
attacking.
Mode was
that's
attack.
Hacking. That's like, hacking.
Go out there and get it.
Yeah.
Right. And I think, you know, coming back to what operators in aerospace can sort of learn from some of that thing, some of that stuff, you know, some of those experiences, I really do think this mode of you gotta control what you can control and you gotta attack, right? Just because you're trying to close this customer and the sales cycle is a year and a half doesn't mean you just kind of like, you know, it's at the whim of the world whether this deal closes.
It's too laissez-faire.
What are you going to do in the meantime mm-hmm. to generate revenue for this company, to keep this company self-sustained?
I think on that note also, there's too many assumptions that are taking for granted.
Yeah.
Because it's always been there.
Yep.
Like throw out all the assumptions.
Yeah.
Pressure test all the assumptions.
Yeah.
Why can't this be done? Or why does it take this long? Or why is this being built this certain way?
Totally.
And I've been banging my head against the wall with a lot of companies where it's I want to see more of that innovation, more of that like break it.
Yeah, and I think it you know, in an interesting way, it starts – I think it all starts with goal setting. And in an interesting way, in aerospace, because the problems are so hard and because people have been, let's say, battered by all the different ways that things can fail, they tend to, like, pull back a little bit in how aggressive of a goal they set for themselves because they try to accommodate for a lot of different things that can go wrong. I think like what's made SpaceX such an incredible company and a lot of the other companies that I see in the sector that are doing really well for themselves, what really sets them apart is this ability to just set extraordinarily aggressive goals and to at the same time make a clear point that scope creep isn't a part of our culture.
Yeah.
So if we have a really intense goal that we need to tackle and there's for some reason or multiple reasons why we can't hit the goal given the current scope. All right, adjust the scope, retain an aggressive goal, adjust the scope, and try to hit the timeline.
Yeah, and I actually, that's a really good point because governments don't like that.
Yeah.
And investors don't like a different approach. There's two
right.
different approaches, and you're trying to take care of two different people.
So and that's a perfect point. So at Gravitics, right? The way that we manage it is we understand that we are dual use business. We're going to have government customers. We are going to have commercial customers.
Right.
We can't build the business culturally to just serve one or the other.
Yeah.
Right. So basically in the organization, there are two different sales cultures around both and two different execution cultures around both, right? One that's really about what infrastructure do we need to be able to wait for the government on their timelines, to be able to capture what their needs are, to understand the full scope of those needs, the 2,000 requirements that they're going to need us. And we understand why the government needs to operate that way, right? But just because we're doing that with the government doesn't mean we're slowing down on the commercial side of
the
business.
But then there's also – I was reading this article, and it was saying how NASA during the Apollo 11 days,
yeah.
the average age of engineers was 28 because you're putting in 80 to 100 hours. And the average age of engineers at SpaceX is, you know, 28.
Yeah.
Because, again, it's, like, very time-consuming and, yeah. and you're, like, backbreaking. And at certain companies, there's, like, the seniority.
Yeah.
Because you've done it for so long, you know better than someone young. I think the ageism in aerospace also, if companies can remove that, that's great. Also, I love to see as an investor, there's a specific company that said, we're going to go do this crazy thing in space. And if we fail, we're out of business. But if we succeed, we're a huge business.
Right.
But when it comes to NASA, you never say we're going to fail. There's like no chance you're going to fail. Yeah. It's like, give us a chance that you're going to fail because that's how you succeed.
Yeah. And in an interesting way, I do think NASA breeds like fear into companies.
Yes.
Right. And I think it's actually
check all the boxes. So there's no chance you fail.
Yeah. I think two things that NASA could do that would be like incredible for the commercial environment. One would be to encourage thoughtful sort of
risk-taking.
Yeah. Risk-taking. And pursuit of some level of failure and understanding that failure drives learnings, right? And so, like, I think, you know, SpaceX failed quite a bit on their way to where they are today.
And you know what they did culturally to allow that speed to increase?
Right.
They gave engineers a silver bullet.
Right.
On a board.
Right.
Like it, where NASA launch would have gotten called down,
yep.
an engineer could have been like, we're taking that risk. And it yep. could have been a single point of decision.
Totally. And I think that's one thing that NASA can do is find sort of the balance there. And I don't think that's being struck right now. I think the other thing is, you know, you go and read about the timelines for the deorbiting of the ISS, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think the most dangerous thing you can do, like as a leader in a space, is to set a deadline for 2030 and then to message sort of every year leading up to that. You know, it might be 2031. It might be 2032. Like it might be 2030. What you do is you just like drain the industry of any sort of like aggressiveness or competition trying to hit a date, right? And so like if I were, you know, NASA and I have this very aggressive goal of we need to commercialize this, I'd be pulling the dates in, right? Because I'd be trying to drive aggressiveness. I'd be trying to get these companies to compete to hit 2029, compete to hit 2030,
that's
right?
Kind of what's happening though.
I mean, that's how it started. But then what's the news from NASA every year, right? It's, oh, you know, we might be willing to delay this out a little longer. We might be willing for this to stretch out to 20. No, if you draw the line at this needs to be done at 2030. I mean, I feel so confident that the sector will collaborate to hit that deadline. But as long as that deadline is unclear, you know, the sector will wait.
Well, I think it's not going to be up to NASA. I think when you see when Starship gets online and starts doing cargo to low Earth orbit, that's going to open up the market for other
totally
commercially feasible stations, I think. And totally. I think we'll see more of them. The fact that NASA has to be an anchor tenant on a station should not be an impeding factor to having space stations proliferate.
Yeah.
And infrastructure proliferate. Totally. So I guess as we wrap up, this has been super helpful and insightful. You
great.
And I have these chats all the time.
Totally.
Because we're banging our head against the wall against the same problems. But what are your three favorite books and three favorite movies?
Three favorite books and three favorite movies. All right, I'll go two fiction and one nonfiction because I've been heavy on the fiction side recently. I think one of my favorite books I've ever read is Dracula.
Dracula.
The original Dracula.
Really? Like the vampire?
The vampire. The reason I love that book so much is it's one of the first times, like it is the first time they've ever described sort of this character, the way that we now know this character today. And as you, the whole book is basically through the lens of someone visiting Count Dracula and realizing for the first time that something is off.
Do you know that it's based off a real person?
Yeah.
Like a real ruler that like put, yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And so what's really interesting about the book is you're just like, you're discovering Dracula for the first time through the eyes of this person that has like no idea what is going on.
Holy hell.
And so I love that book. I finished The Shining recently, which
like the movie Shining?
The original, the book. And I love that book as well. I've been really into sort of the horror thriller genre recently.
I hate horror. I get nightmares when I watch horror films.
I just think the like atmosphere building is so well done. Like you're just sitting there and you're like, oh, like Dracula does a phenomenal job. Shining as well. And then let's see, on the nonfiction side, I read Killers of the Flower Moon before Scorsese made the movie.
So you're into books that are made into movies. You like to read them after you watch the movie or before you watch the movie?
You know, that is actually a good call out. I'm a big fan of books to movies, and I actually try to follow what movies are coming out and try to like get the books before. The reason is because I'm a big movie guy as well, and I like to see the difference and then choose sort of which one I like more. You know, Dracula wins, The Shining, the book wins for me over the movie, which is controversial. And Killers of the Flower Moon book win over movie for me. And then the three movies that I like the most, my favorite movie of all time is Seven, which is Brad Pitt.
And Morgan Freeman. I've seen that one.
Big fan of that movie. Let's see, two others that I really enjoyed these days. You know, I rewatched Sicario recently. Denis Villeneuve. It is an unbelievable movie,
and CJ likes it too.
And Denis is like just so good at storytelling and sound production, and it's just an incredible movie. And I'd say the third one is probably third favorite movie. You know, I've been going really hard on thrillers and horror in this conversation. Yeah, dude,
Have you just been dealing with a lot of horror in the space industry?
I just absolutely have. I've loved it my entire life. I don't know.
Knew that about you. That's my least favorite genre.
And I'm trying to think third movie. What's something fun?
Just say Borat and we'll do some quotes.
Just say Borat. Okay, let's say my third movie is definitely probably – man, I can't
You're pick. Just like Kamala right now. Definitely, probably. I'm thinking still.
Well, I'm trying to find actually a fun, not scary movie, so maybe I'll come back to it.
Okay, yeah. Well, my last question for you that I wanted to ask earlier that this – I don't know why thrillers reminded me of it, but do you ever get – imposter syndrome in your first startup in the space industry? Do you deal with that ever?
Yeah, I think, early in this conversation, we talked a lot about the importance of humility. Uh-huh. I think humility is important because it actually enables self-awareness. Mm-hmm. And generally, I feel like imposter syndrome is really natural for people that are hyper self-aware. Mm-hmm. Because people that are ambitious and hyper self-aware are going to constantly push themselves to do things that they know they might not be set up to do, but that they'll figure it out. Mm-hmm. And the self-awareness is where the imposter syndrome comes in, asking, should I be doing this?
Usually hits on the weekends when you're by yourself. And yeah.
And so I think they just come hand in hand. I constantly have moments of imposter syndrome where I'm like, should I be in this room? Should I be doing this? Am I the one to be able to tackle this?
How do you
this?
Deal with that?
I deal with it by reminding myself that my goal is to give it my best shot.
And even if you fail, it's okay.
Failure's totally okay, and giving it my best shot is really all that I can control. And there's a lot of people out there that don't set really aggressive goals for themselves and don't try to leave it all out there on the field. And I think if every time I remind myself that I'm leaving it all out there on the field and I'm doing it with a lot of ambition, I really care about moving this forward, the imposter syndrome just tends to just fade
go away for like a week.
Yeah.
You can never hit a home run if you don't risk striking out.
100%.
So thank you for being here today, Sandeep.
Of course. Great to be here, man. Thank you.